And we're in the book of Joshua. So turn with me to Joshua 3 and 4. Because today we want to cover two chapters. I won't read as much out of the book. So as you're reading through the scriptures, you can kind of see where this connects up. But again, it's very easy because this time we're going to look at the Israelites who follow the presence of the Lord through the waters of now, in this case, the Jordan River. They've already seen God work through the Red Sea. Now they will see that. Of course, it's very reminiscent to that crossing as well. And at the end, then, they're going to have a memorial. And so we're going to really look at kind of two different principles. The principle, first of all, God's desire to lead his children and some of the obvious application there. And then number two, the idea of a memorial. And then I have noticed that whenever we have a lunch, I am peppered with questions. Many of these came from EJ and Leah, but I have whole slides just answering some of those questions. We're going to go out to lunch today, so you can pepper me with questions as well. And I'm beginning to think that when we go to lunch, I won't eat lunch, because there's enough questions that come that I will try to answer some of those today, and then others which I will answer as we get into the actual siege of Jericho. But you'll also get a chance to see that with the video. And it looks like we have enough time to watch that video a little bit later. So let's get into this whole issue, and when we're looking at Joshua 3, let's at least look at a couple of the verses that kind of get us into it just to set the context. Because here it says, Joshua rose early in the morning, and they set out to Shittim, and then they came to Jordan, and he and all the people of Israel lodged there before they passed over. At the end of 3 days, so they're sitting there for 3 days, the officers went through the camp and commanded the people, as soon as you see the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord, your God, being carried by the Levitical priest, then you shall set out from your place and follow it. Yet there will be a distance between you and it, about 2,000 cubits in length. Do not come near, in order that you may know the way you shall go, for you have not passed this way before. And as we go through here, I'll read a couple of other passages, but here, what we see here is Joshua once again showing leadership. He marches the people to the Jordan River. They camp, and then they stay there for 3 days. I think that's in part to just help them understand what is now before them. This may not be the Red Sea, but in just a minute, I'm going to give you a sense of the dimensions of what the Jordan River was at that point, at that time. But I thought it was interesting. I found a commentary that put it this way. The commentary said the delay also gave everyone an opportunity to get up close and see the river, now a strong and rapid current due to the melting of the winter snows in Mount Hermon. Mount Hermon is in the north of Israel. And this must have faltered at the seeming impossibility of the crossing. The obstacle there is going to be now very clear and overwhelming. Each time, you know, people see that God is going to show up, and then in a sense, some people say God is going to show off, because once again, they are now looking at this river, which is a torrent, because this is during the spring. We know when it is, because it's recorded that it was in the first few days of the Jewish month Nisan, which is in either March or April, depending on how the lunar calendar works. And so now they're going to once again see this. And experts, as I put up here, I looked it up and found out that some experts believe that at this time during the spring floods, the Jordan River was probably at least a mile wide, and the current was flowing at least 10 miles an hour, probably full of brush and everything. This is not even a place where experienced kayakers would probably want to go, because this is pretty significant. And so as a result now, this is, I think, bringing us to the next point, and that is the people would have little doubt that the only way they're going to get across this is through the power of the Lord. And so in the midst of this 3 days now that they are sitting there looking at this, now then he calls for them to get moving and to begin to follow. And the focus now is moving then from the obstacle, that is this torrent river, the Jordan River, which even when you go there in the summer or the fall, is still pretty significant, but really at this point in time seemed almost uncrossable, to now the miracle that's going to take place, and that is the issue of the Ark of the Covenant. So let's go back to verse 4 here, and we see that the first thing they're to do is they're to follow God's direction, and that is that they are going to follow the Ark of the Covenant. Now, if you're not familiar, in other times when the Ark of the Covenant shows up, before this and certainly many times after this, especially in 1 Samuel, it's usually in the midst of a group. It is almost never in front of the group. But just as they had been following the cloud in the day and the pillar of fire at night, now they're going to follow the Ark of the Covenant. So no longer is it in their midst, but it's going to actually blaze a path. And in this particular case, they're about 2,000 cubits behind. Now, you remember the old Bill Cosby joke, what's a cubit, you know? Well, this was a cubit right here. So that gives you a little bit of an idea. If you estimate it, could be about a quarter or to a half of a mile. So they're far enough back that they can actually see what's taking place. But then it's, again, just a visual reminder that God is going before them as they go into this particular place. And they're now going to follow a path that they have never followed before. Then we see in verse 5 this idea that they are to consecrate themselves. They've been there for 3 days, but now before they do this, they consecrate themselves. And what that means is that usually that included all sorts of things, various ritual ceremonies that you can read about in the first 5 books of the Old Testament, known as the Pentateuch. That would involve washing of clothes, might have meant abstaining from sexual relations. They are to now purify themselves as much as they can so that now they are going to be following this holy object, the Ark of the Covenant. And a little bit later, I'm going to show a picture of it and talk a little bit more about what that means. As you can see in your handout, we'll get to that in some of the application point. But now we see that Joshua actually speaks to the people, not his subordinates. This gets into the fact that there is a mass of people, so he could have just simply said, tell all those other people in your groups, you know, tell maybe 12 men to go to the tribes, but instead he speaks to them as well. And again, he is trying to help them understand that indeed this is a very significant event and will be a very significant event, which will give you courage so that you are able to defeat those in Jericho and the other tribes that you run into in Canaan. So this is part of the preparation for the crossing. Now, what was the purpose of the crossing? Well, we see this. They had to cross, obviously, in order to get to the other side, because they are on, at the moment, the eastern side from the Jordan River in today, which would be considered the country of Jordan. And they're now going to cross over to the western side. And once they do so, they'll still be about 7 miles, and sometimes they later camped almost 4 miles away from Jericho. But there is a purpose, number one, for them to cross over. But as we'll see next time when we get together, there is another purpose. And that is, when the people of Jericho see this, they realize that their doom is inevitable. We've already heard last week when we talked about Rahab the harlot, that they had heard about the crossing of the Red Sea. When they see this one take place, in some respects, they have melted. And there is only one defeat that the Israel army faces, which we'll look at in a couple of weeks, and that's because of disobedience. Otherwise, they just kind of clean house, because their enemies are completely demoralized, because they realize now that they are following false gods and the Israelites are following the one true God. One other point I thought I might make here is we see this list here of the 7 wicked nations. And if you're one of those kind of Bible scholars, or if you're one of the skeptics that want to try to find an error in the Bible, you will notice that a number of times when they give us the list of those individuals, if you add them all up, you sometimes come up with as many as 12. Well, I think the point is there were 7 major categories, and so we get the 7 major categories here. And you can see those there in verses 10 and following. The Canaanites, the Hittites, the Hivites, the Perizzites, the Girgashites, the Amorites, the Jebusites. And interestingly enough, one of the great challenges of the Bible in the 19th century was, it talks about the Hittites, it says that they fought the Hittite nation, and yet up to the year 1900, no one had ever found any archaeological evidence of the Hittite nation. And this was one of the arguments that was used to show that the Bible was wrong, and it was engaged in all sorts of myth-making. But then shortly thereafter, we began to find the Hittite nation. You can go to major universities today and study the Hittite language and other Semitic languages, and what we found is the Bible was was right, but the scholars are wrong. But that's the first thing. Number two, sometimes it talks about Canaanites. You notice that one of those groups is called Canaanites, but sometimes the Bible talks about Canaanites as anybody living in Cana. And I thought I would just answer this because this is one particular chapter and book in the Bible where skeptics and atheists use a lot of criticism. It's just full of the need for apologetic answers. And so along the way, I try to give you a few of those, and we're going to hit a few more in just a few minutes. Okay, let's go to verse 12 now. You can see here that now he says, choose 12 representatives. As far as we can tell, they weren't necessarily the leaders of those tribes, weren't necessarily the priests. They were just individuals, and they might have been chosen because of their ability to carry a rock, because we're going to see in just a minute they're going to be carrying some rocks and using this for the memorial. And then, verse 13, to just sit back and watch and wait for God to stop the flow of this torrential river. And it's, in a rainy day, kind of easier to get a sense of what that might have been like in this respect. But it said, as the soles of the priests carrying the ark rested in the Jordan, the water stood up in a heap. We know where that is. It's upstream in the town called Adam. And at this particular point, then, they were able to cross. So that's the purpose of the cross, now crossing. Now, the process they were crossing during, as I mentioned, during the Jewish month Nisan, which is actually the first month in the Jewish calendar. It says it was in the first 10 days, and so that was probably in April, but sometimes the month of Nisan starts in March or April, depending on how the lunar calendar goes, because the Jewish calendar is on a lunar calendar. We use a solar calendar. And even though the spring flood stopped, there have been some that have tried to say, well, maybe it was an earthquake. So I decided to look that up. Okay, has there ever been a time in Israel where there was an earthquake where some of those high walls fell down and prevented the Jordan River for actually a short period of time from being able to go down? And the only two that we can come up with that are recorded, at least, there's one happened in December 8th, 1267. Another one happened July 11th, 1927. Neither of those happened, if you think about it, during the time in which we had the floods, right? The major floods. More importantly, just think about, even if you're trying to come up with some natural explanation. I mean, the walls have to come down early up in the early part of that. It would have to block the water up. Then it's going to take, hours before that makes its way down here. And then when you step in, it's still going to be, what's the river bottom going to be like? Muddy. This is, for those that are trying to find some kind of natural explanation for what happened in the crossing of the Jordan, it doesn't work. You know, this is obviously miraculous. And of course, everybody looking around knew it was miraculous because one minute you got water, the next minute you don't. And as you're going through, they're knocking dust up as they're walking through. And so this is one, again, a incredible miracle, just like the crossing of the Red Sea. Which brings us now to chapter 4. We're moving a little faster today. But again, here we now come to this idea of a memorial. Because after this has taken place, this would have been, I think, for many people sufficient. But the point I think is important is that Joshua, perhaps more than anybody else, understood the importance of telling the next generation of what God has done. After all, there were no photographs. There was no video. Parker was not there with any of his video cameras that we could see later on. So there's nobody that would see this other than the people that saw it there. And so now, when all the nation had finished passing over the Jordan, the Lord said to Joshua, take 12 men from the people, from each tribe a man, and command them, take 12 stones from here in the midst of the Jordan, 12 stones in the midst of the Jordan River, where the priest's feet stood firmly, and bring them over to you and lay them down in this place where you lodge tonight. So then they begin to do this. And so let's now look at this whole issue of 12 men and 12 stones. Here, again, if anybody would understand the importance of passing on these ideas to the next generation, it is Joshua. I mean, he and Caleb saw an entire generation that wandered in the wilderness because, indeed, they were disobedient. And so they were now the story bearers to this next generation. Recognize children that grew up at the end of that, They maybe only heard the story of the Red Sea. They maybe heard a little bit of those who died in the wilderness. But they are now a new generation that needs to know those stories as well. And so here at this moment, Joshua says to the people, take 12 stones from here out of the midst of the Jordan and bring them over here. And so really what you have now are the construction of two memorials. The first memorial is where they are taking the stones from the middle of the Jordan and taking them over to what will be the Gilgal Israelite Memorial Park eventually, because they're now going to establish one of those. And so that's the case. And then as we're going to see in just a minute, Joshua himself arranged another 12 stones in the midst of the Jordan River, which would commemorate where those were. So that at a time when maybe the waters receded, you could actually see some stones and you could also point to those as well. If you think about this, we've done this number of times. You can go to Love Field, and they have a place now on the tarmac where, indeed, Lyndon Johnson took the oath of office. You can, of course, go to Washington, D.C., as I was last week, and you can see the memorial outside of the Pentagon. You can go, of course, to the memorial in New York. I have some friends that were just at the memorial where the plane crashed, and was it Pennsylvania? And so we have done this as well. This is exactly the spot where this took place. Interestingly enough, this now becomes a memorial park, and interestingly enough, he uses this in some very significant ways, because he wanted to have this memorial where the priest's feet stood firmly, and then it was placed where as soon as the feet of the priest were dipped in the brink of the waters were cut off. And so again, you see this interesting cooperation. We have to do our part, God has to do his part. How many times do we see that in Scripture? When Jesus turns water into wine, how does he do so? He tells those individuals, go fill these vats up. They bring the vats, and then he turns it into wine. I mean, we see so many times where God says, you do your part, then I do my part. You do your part, and then I show up. And here we see that working out very well. Now, here's what's so interesting about this. The priests are in the midst of what was a riverbed, now a dry riverbed, and maybe they can't see the water, but they know that sooner or later that water's coming down. If you look through I forget which verse it is, but in chapter 4, at one point it says the people passed by the priest in haste. Wouldn't you? You know, if you're in that, you know, 1 mile stretch of water, which is no longer water, but you know the water's coming again. Would you just kind of look around like this? I think I got the sense that everybody's moving real fast. What must it have been like for the priest with the Ark of the Covenant going, we're in the fat middle of this, you know. If we are disobedient or God's miracle runs out before we get out of here, we are in a lot of trouble because that water is just going to come and knock us down. And so you see that here they are there, and now the people stand on the west bank. And then the priests come back, and the moment the priests hit their feet to the west bank, the waters start again. Now, it occurred to me that this is a very visual reminder of there's no turning back. You ever heard the phrase, burn the bridges behind you? Well, how about this one? When Cortez came in the 16th century to Mexico, they got off the ships, they fought a battle or two, and then some of the men were overwhelmed by the fact that they were now going to go against the army of Montezuma, and they were outnumbered tremendously. So there was a mutiny where a few of the men got on a ship and they tried to sail to Cuba. He stopped that, and so Cortez said, I know how to fix this. He scuttled all the ships and sank them. They kept one ship just to send some of the gold back to the king, what was called the king's portion, with 20%, one-fifth. But basically, can you imagine that you are in Mexico, you're from Spain, and you see these ships going down? Do you see the implication of it? Matter of fact, there was a question asked of Cortez, how are we going to get back to Spain? He says, we're going to sail back on their ships. Isn't that interesting? And this is the same kind of thing. You know, no partial involvement now. 100% buy-in. Pastor Graham was talking about that today. You know, are you there 100%? Well, now they're there 100%. They have the Jordan River behind them. They have Jericho in front of them. What are we going to do? We're going to fight. That's no other choice at this point. Now, again, the memorials there remind them of the things that once were, but also of the things that were to come. And interestingly enough, the steps across the Jordan should not be lost in this generation, because they even give an instruction here about what do you say when the little ones, in other words, when your children ask, why is there that memorial? And we see that they say, first of all, then you shall let your children know Israel passed over the Jordan on dry ground. For the Lord your God dried up the waters of the Jordan for you until you passed over, as the Lord your God did to the Red Sea, which he dried up for us until we passed over. And so this now becomes a memorial. It's the Gilgal Israelite Memorial Park. You know, and anytime somebody's in Gilgal, young people might say, well, what are all those stones there for? And that is the case. And of course, we see that Gilgal now has a tremendous amount of historical significance. Next week, we will talk about the fact that there was circumcision that took place there. Passover took place there as well. Samuel at one point called it a city of judgment. If you remember from 1 Samuel, that's where Saul goes to actually be anointed king. And if you've read some of the minor prophets, as we talked about just about a year ago, both Hosea and Amos speak out against some of the apostasy there in Gilgal. So this name Gilgal shows up again and again and again. And it's a place, of course, where we have those memorials. Well, let's see if we can talk about three points of application. If you're on your notes here, you might want to look at a few of those. And the first application is we talk about this idea of the Ark of the Covenant. We never really talked about this too much in the class, but according to Deuteronomy 10, the priests were responsible for carrying the Ark. But how did they carry it? I'm going to show a picture of it in just a minute. They carried it with poles so that they would not actually touch the Ark. Matter of fact, what happens if you did touch the Ark? If you wanted to have a little bit of fun, there is a picture. You can type in Ark of the Covenant, Barack Obama, and somebody brought him an Ark of the Covenant, and you can see a picture of him touching that. Now, if that was the real Ark, we would need a new president, but nevertheless, it's kind of a fun little picture of him wanting to, and even if I wasn't sure, I'm just not sure I'd want to touch it, right? You know, if nothing else, seen Raiders of the Lost Ark, but nevertheless, you can type that, it's kind of fun. But this is what it looked like, and it was beautiful. Some people wonder if it still exists. You know, there's some that said it was carried off to Babylon. There are some that are arguing that the Ark of the Covenant is in Ethiopia. There have been people that have gone to that place and said that the individuals who are guarding it believe that it is. Who knows? But nevertheless, you can see that it has, as we have there, the cherubim and the seraphim and all of those that are part of this. And this is where, of course, the tablets of the Ten Commandments reside and all sorts of other things. And so this was significant, but it was most important because it showed the presence of the Lord. And here the Lord is leading them across to the Jordan River. The priests stop. Hastily, we now read in the scriptures, run by, they go to the other side. And so that is the Ark. And so it again represents its importance. And as I mentioned here, God is seated on the cherubim. The cherubim are represented as winged lions with human faces were placed on each side of the Ark. And we see that in Exodus 25. And so if you'd like to do a little bit of a study about that, I gave you a couple of those verses that you can look at, especially, you know, if you want to do this for your quiet time one time this morning, go to Exodus 25. It tells us a lot more about the manufacturing of the Ark of the Covenant, and that will be important as we go through the book of Joshua. Second point is stones. And if you think about it, rocks and stones were really important in the Old Testament. For example, Yahweh is referred to as the Rock of Israel. In Isaiah 26, it talks about the fact that the Lord is the Rock Eternal. And then we have, of course, stones. You have stories, for example, Jacob pushed the stone off the well so Rachel's sheep could feed, and they use that to protect it. Later on, when Rachel dies, Jacob builds what? A pillar over her grave, you know, kind of a memorial. Many people say, where did the idea of having a cemetery, a memorial park? Some of that is in the Old Testament. Much more of it is in the New Testament. We'll talk about that maybe in the future, because this was unknown before that time. And this is why to this day there's some that will take you to Israel and they can point you to where we think Jacob's grave is and some things of that nature, because they began to actually have memorials for them. So rocks and stones are very important in the Old Testament. Rocks and stones, very important in the New Testament. I didn't know the pastor was going to be preaching on Peter today, but what a great connection there. You know, here where Jesus and Peter and the disciples are in a very significant place, interesting enough, Caesarea Philippi, which was a pagan area where you have the Temple of Zeus and the Temple of Apollos. You have the Gate of Pan, which was seen as the gate to hell. And here he tells Peter that in the midst of this stone edifice, you are the rock. You are the foundation upon which we're going to build you, and I will build my church, and the gates of hell will not prevail against it. And so certainly that was important. And then Peter later on, when he's writing about Jesus, refers to him as the stone the builders rejected, who has become what? The capstone. The third and final point I thought I'd make is what about when children ask? And these rocks of remembrance were really there to teach future generations. And if there's anything that we should be about, we should pass on spiritual lessons to our children and to our grandchildren. I mean, that's what we do here. And we honored some of you that today are involved in children's ministry to stand. And we certainly do honor you. And Deuteronomy 6 talks about the fact that, hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. Love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your strength. And they were to actually to teach this as they were going about their day. They were to tie symbols on their hands. They actually had frontals to remind that on their foreheads. They were to write them on their door frames and their gates, the need to constantly remember what God is doing. So if nothing else, this is a quick look at Exodus 3 and 4. Next week we'll get into Joshua 3 and 4, Joshua 5 next week. But I did want to try to answer some of the questions that surface so often when we talk about Joshua. And the first question that I got around the table last week was, well, how many people were involved in the Exodus? Well, we have a pretty good answer for that, because it turns out in Numbers chapter 1, it tells us there were over 600 men, which suggests that then there were probably about 200 million people that crossed over the Red Sea. As we'll hear a little bit later, this is a problem, because there's no evidence at the time when people thought the Exodus took place of 2 million slaves of Semitic origin leaving Egypt, at least at the time when many people thought that that took place. Then a lot of people said, well, how many people crossed the Jordan River? Again, the estimates are sometimes 2 million. That's a guess. We don't really have that one. But you might say, well, then they never really grew in numbers. We've got to recognize that after the Exodus, there were a couple of times when people were killed off. The first, of course, is when Moses comes down from Mount Sinai. Later on, you have Korah's rebellion. Then you have a battle they fight with the Amalekites. So some never made it to time to have children. Others may have had some children, but all of them die off. So the estimates are maybe there were 2 million people that crossed that 1 mile crossing of the Jordan River. I think that number's got to be high for the third one, because I remember EJ saying, well, how many fought the battle? Well, we have that number because we just looked at it. Look at chapter 4, verse 13. It tells us that there were 40,000 men who were armed. You only had 40,000 out of 2 million that could fight? That doesn't seem right. The ratio's off. I mean, even if you thought that you had 500,000, that would be 500,000. 40,000 would be less than 10%. So I'm not so thinking that maybe we had 2 million, but nevertheless, we don't really know that number. But we do know that now 40,000 armed men are going to go after Jericho. And Jericho is a fortress, as we talked about before. Now, one of the other questions I got last week, Leah was asking that, well, did all the walls fall down? Well, no. As it turns out, we're going to see a video here in just a minute, when they excavated Jericho, first some Germans and then some English and later Kathleen Kenyon, they found that there was one part of the wall, the northern part of the wall, that did not fall down. Well, that's interesting. Most of the wall fell down, but part of the wall did not. And they even found that there was a house built into that wall. Anybody think of who might have been living there at the time? Yeah, see? So even the archaeology is, you know, can we prove that that was her house? No. That's where I think faith comes in. But it is intriguing that most of the walls are down, and there the town is burned, And then when they did more excavation, they found whole areas of grain. It wasn't like there was a siege. It looked like it happened quickly. And they were so full that it must have happened during harvest. And harvest at that time was in April. And that all starts fitting together with maybe indeed that's the case. But the problem is Kathleen Kenyon says, yeah, but this, when the Exodus and the conquest took place, is too late. And so what I want to show you real quickly is a video that is now making the argument that actually the Exodus and the conquest did not happen in the late Bronze Age. It happened in the middle Bronze Age. And if that's the case, then all of a sudden all the archaeological discrepancies line up. So, guys, are we about ready to show that if we can? Let's, if we can,
but
show
again,
part of this video.
What if it happened in the earlier middle Bronze Age? It seemed only logical to begin by looking at the key site of Jericho, the first city the Israelites are said to have destroyed. And we know exactly where that was.
Major archaeological excavations at Jericho began with a German team in the early 1900s, led by Ernst Sellin. This was followed by a British team headed by John Garstang in the 1930s. At the time of their digs, both Sellin and Garstang believed they had uncovered a layer of destruction that matched the biblical story. However, things took a dramatic turn when Kathleen Kenyon dug at Jericho in the 1950s. She demonstrated that there was no evidence for a destruction of Jericho matching the biblical account because she dated the demise of the city much earlier. A wave of skepticism began to sweep across the field of archaeology. In an instant, Kenyon's discoveries at Jericho had undermined the entire Exodus story.
She was expecting that if there was any evidence there at all, it would be in what we call the late Bronze Age. And it simply isn't there. If the Israelites had arrived in the 13th century, they'd have found almost nobody there, no walls to collapse. It just wouldn't have fitted the biblical narrative. So her excavations helped to compound this very negative view that was developing, not just from Jericho, but from other sites as well.
Is there a time when Jericho was destroyed, where the walls fell down or it was burned?
I don't think so. I don't think that we have evidence, this kind of evidence in the case of Jericho. And I don't think that we can really look for this evidence. We are very much past this phase of archaeological research.
But David Roll sees things differently.
If people are telling us that there was no Jericho at the time that Joshua conquered the Promised Land, and therefore Joshua is a piece of fiction, and therefore the conquest is a piece of fiction, and then probably Exodus is a piece of fiction as well, if that's the case, why don't we ask the simple question, well, when was Jericho around? When was Jericho destroyed? And start from that point of view.
The conquest began with the Israelites crossing the Jordan River. Joshua sent men to spy out the massively walled city of Jericho, and there they met a harlot named Rahab, who reported that all in the land had heard what God had done for the Israelites, and they were terrified. Rahab hid the spies and aided their escape to the mountains.
What evidence do you see matching the conquest of Jericho?
First of all, we're told that Jericho was fortified. When the archaeologists dug the city, particularly Kathleen Kenyon, when she did her work in the 50s, discovered that the tell that the city's built on was surrounded by a great earthen rampart.
Excavators found that Jericho was protected by a brilliant defensive system. At its base was a stone retaining wall more than 15 feet high, with a defensive extension wall of mud bricks rising higher still. Beyond this was the rampart, a steep slope covered with a slick surface of white plaster, where attackers would have been exposed to arrows and sling stones from above. At the top of this rampart was the main city wall, also made of mud brick, this one more than 25 feet high and 10 feet thick.
Imagine the dread and the desperate panic of the people of Jericho. Day after day for 6 days, the people of Israel are walking around their city with the Ark of the Covenant and the sounding of ram's horns. Then on the seventh day, They encircle the city seven times, and the priests give a long blast on their horns. The people let loose with a mighty shout. The walls come tumbling down. Allowing the Israelites to climb up into the city, taking it, and commencing the conquering of the land of Israel.
Well, when the city met its end, these mud brick walls collapsed, and they actually fell down to the base of the stone retaining wall. Kenyon describes it very clearly and in detail in her excavation report. And then we're told they set the city on fire. And that's exactly what we find. Jericho was massively destroyed by fire. Kenyon said it was very clear that within the city, the walls of the buildings had fallen as well. And she says that the walls fell before the fire. And so we have the sequence that we read in the Bible. First, the fallen walls, and then the city being set on fire by the Israelites.
Excavations at the site uncovered clear evidence for a massive destruction by fire with a very thick burn layer of extremely high temperatures. This caused Kenyon to attribute the burning to an enemy attack and not fires that would result solely from an earthquake.
She claimed that the city was destroyed around 1550 B.C. by the Egyptians. Well, there's absolutely no evidence that the Egyptians were ever in the Jordan Valley at this time period.
So because Kenyon dated the destruction of Jericho 150 years before the Israelites were supposed to be there, she made no connection between the destruction and the biblical account. But once again, this date fits the earlier pattern I've been seeing.
Within the city, a very unique discovery was made. Both Garstang and Kenyon found in the houses that they excavated many jars full of grain that were stored there.
The store jars in the city were pretty full. That suggests the harvest had only recently been gathered in. The details in the biblical account point to an event that happened sometime in the spring. And down there in the Jordan Valley, spring is when the harvest is gathered in, the grain harvest.
When the Israelites crossed the Jordan.
We'd probably stop there, but is that kind of interesting? You know, the biggest issue, though, is what you will hear if you go to a class in archaeology, say, in the government schools and things like that, universities, is, well, it was too late. But if we take the biblical account, all we have to do is move the Exodus and the conquest a little bit earlier than many people thought, in the middle of the Bronze Age. And so in the next couple of weeks, we're going to talk about the siege of Jericho. But I wanted to give you a little bit of a preview just before we finish class today. And if you start with that assumption, and isn't it interesting that certainly the German archaeologist and even the British archaeologist Garstang said this fits perfectly into the biblical model. Because here you have the walls falling outward, which wouldn't happen in an earthquake necessarily because they could fall either which way. They drop down, then the city is burned, and you find that it was obviously not a siege because we still have huge storehouses of grain, which were obviously brought in the spring. Does that all match pretty well? It certainly does. But it was Kathleen Kenyon in the 1950s to say, yeah, but it's just too late. When the conquest took place, Jericho was not a fortified city. It was simply in ruins. So, again, it's one of those ones. You're going to accept the Bible. You can accept the word of a secular archaeologist. Well, I know where I'm going to choose. And that's why some of the people are saying if we change some of the time frames, everything links up. Next couple of weeks, we're going to talk about also how this fits into some other patterns. Because one of the other ones that I've mentioned is we don't really see any evidence of, just think of 2 million people leaving from Egypt. If we just even had 2 million Americans leave right now, or illegal aliens or slaves or whatever, you know, you could see that would have some impact. But if you go and recalibrate that, you find that there was a time when Egypt was in a lull, a financial lull, and losing all of your workers, that would certainly put them in a lull. So this is why some people are starting to say maybe if we readjust some of our time frames, that is the case. That may be more than you wanted to know about, but it's just a good illustration once again that even when we don't have all the answers, we have found that in the past, whenever there's been a challenge to the Bible on archaeology or history, eventually we find that the Bible is right and the skeptics are wrong. Parker?